Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do we owe to animals? They share our planet and very often share our homes. And yet most of us have very complicated and often inconsistent ideas about our obligations to them and about how and when it is appropriate to use them for food, work, entertainment, and experimentation. My guest today embraces those complications and, in fact, worries most about the members of human society who see the rights of animals or lack thereof as a simple black and white issue. Jean Cazes is adjunct professor of philosophy at SMU. She explores some of the questions that surround the ethical treatment of the world's non-human creatures in her newest book, Animal Kind, What We Owe to Animals. Jean, welcome back to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
One of the things you take on here is the question of animal consciousness and how it relates to our obligations to animals. What can we say for certain about the balance between instinct and thought in animals?
I think that we have a kind of preconception of animals that says they are entirely instinctive. And I think that it, in a way, is sort of a holdover from very old ideas, even sort of from the 17th century. Descartes thought that animals were really literally robots, you know, with furry robots that sort of did everything automatically. So I think today we're sort of past that, and we do, I think most people think that animals can feel pain and pleasure, but they think of them as being entirely automatic in the sense of governed by instinct. And I think that's just not true. And there's just all sorts of evidence that animals are amazingly thoughtful in the way they go through the world. In fact, the thoughtfulness goes way further down the spectrum of animals than you would ever think. There's a very interesting book about animal architects that gets into even spiders and how they weave webs. And you'd think that would be just an entirely automatic process, but it turns out that it's not, that there are, we can actually have experimental evidence that spiders, they fix problems in their webs in a non-automatic fashion.
And some people will say they can think maybe about a problem, but they cannot imagine what's to come. So that if you have an animal in a pen somewhere and it's scheduled for slaughter, that maybe it's not so cruel if they never feel the pain that's coming and they can't worry about it ahead of time.
Well, I think it's very, very hard to get inside of an animal's mind and to figure out something like that. So I think that's one of the raging debates among animal psychologists, whether animals have what is called time travel, where you actually can sort of think about the future events as being in the future, and also think about past events. So the evidence about that is very mixed and very complicated and very hard to sort out. But, you know, I think it's probably true that a cow on the way to slaughter does not anticipate what's going to happen next in the way a human being does. And that does make a moral difference.
What plays into our decisions about the relative value of a human life over the relative value of any animal life?
Okay. Well, I think this is a super tricky topic because as soon as you say anything, you're going to sound very elitist and sort of biased and like you're kind of elevating human capacities and, you know, putting people on a pedestal. So in a way, we kind of all go around really believing there are these value differences. And I think even the most ardent animal activists really do believe that. But when you articulate it, it sort of sounds bad. So I will attempt to sort of say something about that, knowing that anything I say will sound bad. But I mean, I think it does add extra value to lives, to human lives, that we are self-aware, that we do have the capacity for morality, you know, much beyond what we find in animals. I mean, I think we find some something like morality in animals, but we have more. We find some creativity in animals, you know, but there's more in human beings. So I think in a lot of these cases, it's not really true that there's a black and white difference where there's just nothing of the impressive sort, you know, none of these impressive capacities in animals. But we just find them much, much more highly developed in human beings, most of them. I mean, I think that's not true across the board. For example, animals are just these incredible navigators. They're animals that migrate pole to pole, you know, and how the hell do they do that? You know, we really don't know. So it's not true that for every impressive capacity, you know, humans would win at some kind of cross-species Olympics. But in a lot of cases, we do win on the capacities we do take to have special value.
There's an interesting set of choices and values we place on human lives. For example, people who are the most vulnerable, children and the elderly and the infirm, get special care. Yeah. Whereas often when we're looking at animals, if an animal is not doing well, people have less of a problem with things like euthanasia or with simply valuing them according to which ones are most likely to survive in a given situation.
Well, that's actually a very mixed thing, because I think we also have special concern for impaired or injured animals. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, we always have this big to-do when a whale sort of washes up on a beach.
Well, it's hard to ignore.
It's hard to ignore, but there was actually a Simpsons episode about that recently where Lisa was terribly concerned about the whale on the beach and, you know, the whole community was rallying around trying to do something about it. Whereas, in fact, we fish and whale, they're still whaling, going on in some parts of the world, without a lot of concern. So the very fact that an animal is in trouble seems to elicit extra concern. Now, it's true that there's also the willingness to perform euthanasia on animals that are very sick. But, you know, in fact, we do have – many people think that's okay for humans too. Although we're much, much more strict about that and have a lot of – there are a lot more considerations.
Well, most people who think about euthanasia for someone who is sick want that person to have been able to make the choice him or herself, whereas an animal is unable to do so.
Right. Animals are unable to do so. So there are many differences in the ethical – you know, what's ethical with regard to animals and what's ethical with regard to people. I mean, for example, we spay and neuter animals and everybody thinks that's great. You know, all animal advocates say that's great. But we can't ask them if that's okay. And if we did the same thing to humans without asking them if that's okay, we think that was just, you know, a travesty.
Mm-hmm. How does it work? I mean, it's funny because, you know, if you have a raft and you can save a baby or a kitten, I think almost everybody would say save the baby first if there's only room. But it's pretty rare that it's us or them in those black and white situations. So is there a useful sort of problem that you can set out there as an example to think about these questions?
Yes. I mean, I think that kind of thing is just, you know, fodder for philosophy classes. And then philosophers love the raft that has the baby and the kitten. And, you know, you can have it four men and a dog. I mean, there's all kinds of interesting combinations. But there are real world situations like that. For example, dealing with natural disasters and, for example, the evacuation of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. People really had to struggle with this issue of whether to save humans first or animals at the same time. And I think in the days after Katrina, there were these sort of heart-wrenching scenes on TV of people wanting to take their pets, and rescue workers had to make these decisions. So I think, you know, we actually do need to think about those things.
Yeah, the tough part about that was such an interesting – that's a great example, because there are people who say, well, if there's only this much room on the bus, you have to take humans before you take people's pets. But there were also humans that ended up being left behind because they refused to leave their pets.
Very true. And that's why I have to just applaud the Humane Society for doing such a great job in the years since Katrina to prepare better for the next disaster. And also we've had federal legislation that says that disaster planning has to include pets. And that's partly because people care more about pets these days or something, and they felt bad about those images, but also because they realize that many humans will just not leave their pets behind. So if you want to save humans, you've got to make plans for the pets. And so I think it was really striking during Hurricane Ike to see the new images on TV, actually of the Dallas Convention Center, where you had all these big cages and tagged pets. And there had been this incredible amount of planning done so that animals would not be left behind again.
Now we have the BP oil spill and a lot of concern about wildlife as related to this. How do we make decisions about how much of our resources to spend caring for animals who might have been harmed by something that we as human beings have done to the environment?
I think I don't have the answer to that. I mean, I think with that oil spill, there is a sort of ironic situation where some of the concern for animals is about animals that would have been killed by fisheries.
Sure.
And so what we're actually really concerned about is the livelihood of fishermen and so on and so forth. But when it comes to just pure wildlife, you know, I don't really know how to put a dollar amount on it. I mean, I think wildlife matters just inherently, and we really feel that way if we really think about it. But it also makes human beings enjoy living in this world more, and so we have to care about wildlife both for their sake and for our sake. Now, what that really means in dollar cents terms, I honestly don't know.
Is it unethical to have a sort of preference for mammals or a bias toward mammals as opposed to fish and lizards and snakes?
I think if you look at those issues, you sort of look at the lines, they are actually very blurred. And there used to be this idea that sort of humans first, and then you kind of go down there to our closest living relatives, the chimpanzees, and then maybe you go down a little further, and there are these sort of very extra special species that are all mammals. And now I think that as we've done more research, or psychologists have done more research, we now know that it's really not exactly that way. Birds are amazingly intelligent. I mean, for example, Irene Pepperberg's research on parrots really will take away that notion that, you know, there's a sort of mammal superiority and primate superiority. Now, when you get down further to lizards, for example, to reptiles, I mean, I think there are differences, and you want to research them, you want to understand them, and they might make an ethical difference. For example, the evidence that reptiles feel pain is not as compelling as the evidence that other families of animals feel pain. For example, apparently when a reptile, when you sort of when a reptile loses a bit of a foot, it doesn't engage in the behavior that's called pain guarding, where the animal avoids stepping on that foot. So, and, you know, a cow will avoid stepping on an injured foot. Reptiles apparently don't do that. So, you know, there are differences, and we should notice them.
How do we need to think about protecting one animal species from another? Sometimes you'll hear about, you know, coyotes or wolves attacking either people's dogs or domesticated agricultural animals.
Well, let's see. I mean, I think, you know, people, we have the institution of, you know, raising animals for food, and that's people's property, and, you know, they have a natural desire to protect their own property. I mean, I think given that that's how our society works, they have a right to do that. You know, I don't think that there's any sort of special value to livestock over wildlife. You know, if anything, it's the opposite.
And then, of course, there's the argument that I know that you've discussed before, which is the idea that there is humane agricultural use of animals, and then there is the less responsible. Is that a reasonable distinction to make?
So it's sort of between humanely, you know, quote, humane meat and eggs,
right,
and milk versus, you know, ordinary. I think that there are substantial differences there that people should be aware of. And, you know, for example, ordinary eggs come from chickens that are who live out their lives in these tiny cages where they have about as much space as a piece of typing paper. Whereas so-called humane eggs come from chickens that aren't in cages at all. And that's a big difference. However, if you look into it, you will find out that life is not, you know, a bowl of cherries for the so-called humanely raised chickens.
It's not necessarily Farmer Brown's farm.
No, it is not actually, unfortunately.
Jean Cazes is with us. She's adjunct professor of philosophy at SMU and has just written a new book called Animal Kind, What We Owe to Animals. Join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is SMU adjunct professor of philosophy Jean Cazes. Her newest book is called Animal Kind, What We Owe to Animals. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. So I want to get down to this very complicated question of using animals for gaining scientific knowledge.
Yeah.
The Texas A&M Veterinary School takes a really interesting approach to this because instead of, in most cases, instead of infecting an animal with something so that they can study the effect of a treatment, they will search literally nationwide when they can for an animal that naturally has this disease, and then they'll experiment. Does that make it okay?
Well, I mean, I think the first question is, you know, should we be doing any animal experimentation? And I think my view is that we should, there are experiments that are so necessary that they can be justified. So if you have a goal, if there are, you know, important benefits that can be brought from doing an experiment, then sure, if you can find an animal that has that problem in the first place, fantastic. Much better way to proceed than to infect a healthy animal. Now, unfortunately, I'm sure that that they will be the first to say that's not always possible, because sometimes the disease under study is one that just does not naturally affect dogs or does not naturally affect any species but us.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go first to Maureen in Austin. Hi, Maureen.
Hi. My question is, seeing that pets have now become such an important member of people's families, like surrogate children, do you see in the future people being able to use sick leave at work in order to take care of a sick pet like people can with their children?
It certainly seems possible. I mean, I think people have personal days. In most companies, there are personal days already. So you don't always have to explain why you're taking time off. And that might be a good application for a good way for people to stay home with pets. Of course, that's sort of giving them less status than children. But I see the point. I certainly think it makes sense to somehow enable people to take care of their responsibilities.
What do we need to think about in terms of the ethics of using animals for our entertainment? Let's start with something like a zoo. And we know there are the old school zoos with the cage, but let's assume we're talking about a zoo that is, large and airy and the animals have room to move around. Should we assume that they are worse off in captivity than they would be in any other situation in the wild?
I think it really depends on the species. So if you kind of go around the Dallas Zoo, you will, in fact, just see very different things. For example, it seems to me that, I'm not a monkey expert, but the monkeys look really happy to me. They like to perform. They're swinging around. They're very active. On the other hand, you know, right across the way, the tigers, if you learn about tigers, you realize just how incredibly their lives are restricted by being in that area, even though it's a very large area and looks much nicer than a cage. It's still an incredible reduction in, you know, what their lives are for them to be in that zoo. So I'm very reluctant to think well of using animals for entertainment. So if a zoo's real purpose is just entertainment, I have to say that on the whole, you know, apart from some species, it seems like a sort of bad idea. On the other hand, I think there is an argument for zoos which says that wildlife, you know, out in the wilderness is under terrible threat today, and we just could not get people to have concern about that if they didn't sort of see animals in real life. I mean, videos are fantastic, but to really see a tiger up close and personal is a way of getting people to care about how few tigers there are left in the wild, and that is about 3,000 left in the wild, sort of an incredible statistic. So I understand zoos having a value from that point of view, but sheer entertainment, I think, it's very hard to justify.
When is it okay to expect an animal to work?
Well, good question. I mean, I think it's some people on that sort of very far side of the spectrum, say just not at all. To have a animal pulling a plow is just to treat that animal as a slave. I mean, I think there are people who literally think that that an ox pulling a plow is a slave. I just can't see it that way, because I think that that amounts to confusing, you know, animals for people and sort of imagining what it would be for a human being to pull a plow. So, I mean, sort of you picture in India, you know, what's the difference between an ox pulling a plow and a human being pulling a rickshaw? Well, big difference. So for animals to work is not always bad. I mean, I think it has to do with whether they suffer in that work, whether they can live, you know, complete good lives. I don't think work is necessarily a bad thing. It sort of can give life some sort of content. I think there are problems with some of our pets today that they don't do any work. I mean, they're you know, I have indoor cats who don't do anything for their living. I mean, no, they sort of get bored, I think, from overprotection. So work is not necessarily bad for animals.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email think@kera.org. I knew this would come up. We have an email here from Jen who wants to know about what you eat.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, that's actually sort of complicated. I am a vegetarian and I've been a vegetarian for 17 years. That has been a sort of long, slow process of kind of giving things up and giving more things up. Actually, before I became a vegetarian, I gave up veal. That was based on seeing a bunch of protesters in front of a Burger King in Boston a long time ago. I learned how veal calves are treated. I thought it was just horrible. I was not going to ever eat veal again, and I haven't. Then some years later, I learned more about how other animals are treated. I particularly saw videos about factory farming, and I thought it was just, you know, horrible and repugnant. And so not long after that, I became a vegetarian. Later after that, I started to realize that there really are issues about eggs and milk. Unfortunately, those things sort of look innocent because they don't obviously involve killing. But they're not so innocent. So I started shifting to humane eggs and humane milk, which are not perfectly humane, but they're better. More recently, I've stopped eating fish, except for occasionally. So this is all sort of, I'm sort of, you know, heading in the direction of not eating animal products, but I'm not there, and I'm not sure if I will get to that sort of point of perfection. But that's where I am right now.
You know, there are people who would make the argument that unless you're willing to be a vegan and really commit yourself to that, that you're not really helping and you're not really an animal rights advocate.
Yes, I'm actually surprised that there are people like that. And I didn't, and you know, I honestly did not realize that until about 6 months ago. I was living in this sort of, you know, innocent universe in which I thought that all people who cared about animals were sort of on one team. And then I kind of realized that there are sort of vegans out there who I always looked up to, honestly, as just doing more. And I kind of realized that some of those people are a sort of really do believe that either you're a vegan or you're just not helping the cause at all. I don't know why they really think that. I think that's a very, very unproductive way to think about these things. And in fact, I don't think that it's true that either you're a vegetarian or you're not doing anything. I think reducing the exploitation of animals and the harm inflicted on animals is a great thing. You know, even if you do it to a much lesser degree than going all the way to being a vegetarian or a vegan.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Jean Cazes is my guest. Her new book is called Animal Kind: What We Owe to Animals. Let's go next on the phone to Earl in McKinney. Hey, Earl.
Hello, Chris and Jean. This is a great show.
Thanks.
She brought this up a minute ago about veal, and I was wondering exactly how do they do that veal, and is there any other kind of animals that they actually? She mentioned it was very inhumane. I'm not sure exactly what they do, but is there any other kind of treatments that some of our food gets that's unduly inhumane?
I'm guessing you gave up foie gras around the time you gave up veal.
No foie gras. No. Yeah. Well, the way veal calves are treated is very strange. Basically, what goes on there is the veal industry takes baby cows, and they're all male because they're sort of the surplus from the egg industry. And what they want to do is sort of create the biggest baby, the biggest calf they can in order to make more money. So to create a really big calf, what you want to do is stop it from moving so it won't develop tough muscles. So they actually just tether veal calves to very narrow stalls to just prevent them from moving. Now, this is not 3 hours a day and not let them out for breaks and like amble on the pastures, you know. No, no, it's 24 hours a day. That's their whole life. They're also prevented from eating solid food, I believe. They sort of are supposed to be kept on a kind of baby diet and to keep their flesh very tender. And I think that's just, you know, really horrific. Now, there are other animals that are given limited space in a similar way. Pork is a particular issue because particularly the pregnant pigs are treated terribly. And it's very similar kind of thing where gestating sows are kept in pens where they literally can't move. I mean, it's sort of an astonishing sight. It's like, as I say in my book, it's like a car parked in a parking lot. There just is no room to move. And these pigs are re-impregnated over and over and over again. So again, that's practically their whole life, being sort of stuck in this weird little stall 24 hours a day.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Flower Mound and speak with Lucy. Hello, Lucy. Hi, Lucy. Okay, we will move on and speak to Ian in Fort Worth. Hi, Ian.
Oh, afternoon. I'm wondering, is there any explanation for this arachnophobia that so many people, not least myself, I might add, feel about spiders? I mean, they're peculiarly horrible to me. Is there any rational explanation for it, do you think?
It's an interesting point that there are certain animals we'll protect, but somehow insects are in a class, and spiders, yeah, which are arachnids, are a totally different sort of mental class for a lot of people.
Yeah, I don't really know what the explanation is. I don't have that feeling at all. When we find a spider in our house,
I think they're cute.
Yeah, we think they're cute. We just get a piece of paper, get it onto the paper, and take it outside. I have that same feeling about a lot of different insects. Now, cockroaches, you know, are another story. And this may be because I lived in Boston for a while, and there are a lot of cockroaches in apartments in Boston. And so there is this kind of creepy feeling of something scurrying, you know, in the dark. And, you know, but why it is that people have these different reactions and what different species they react to, you know, I don't really know the psychology of that. I think that's an interesting question.
When you are teaching students about this, what are the things that I would imagine over a variety of semesters, certain perspectives have taken you by surprise? Can you talk about some of those?
Yeah, I actually find I get a fair number of hunters who take my classes. There must be, you know, two or three or four hunters every semester. And what I find surprising about them is that they're often really interested in grappling with the question of what they do and whether it's right. So where some students might be in the class and sort of resent having to look beyond the surfaces and sort of resent the pressure to examine their beliefs and their actions, hunters want to talk about these things. They are often more concerned about animals, more concerned about environmental issues than the average student, and they struggle. And I really would I'd love to be able to, you know, absolve them of their worries, because they do have some worries. But I find the whole idea of sort of killing for fun a very odd thing, although I don't think it's a worse thing than what we normally do to factory farmed animals. But getting back to your question, I do find the hunters interesting.
That's an interesting question all around, because I think there are a lot of people who hunt and then make a point of eating the meat or sharing the meat. And there are still people who find that abhorrent but don't have a problem, you know, running down to Safeway and picking up,
You know. I think they're just wrong about that, because I think the hunted animal has a normal life. I mean, I think most of the time. Now, it could be shortened, you know, by hunting. I don't think that death at, you know, by gunpoint, I don't think that's necessarily a good death. But when you compare an animal's life, you know, birth to death, who comes to an end as a result of hunting, to an animal in a factory farm situation, really the hunted animal is much better off. So if we're really thinking about these things with a view to animals and impact on animals, there's no reason to be terribly, especially judgmental about hunters.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Murali in Plano. Hi, Murali.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Jean.
Hi.
I agree with you with a lot of the points, but you made one reference to a person pulling rickshaw in India to the animal plowing a field, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of thought one is right and one is wrong, right? So, but I kind of think that that's a little bit of a American idea being imposed on a society that's at a different stage of development. What I mean by that is, in fact, if you go back to when America got independence, or 50 to 60 years just after independence, we were also at a different level of understanding, right?
Yeah.
And also, if you consider the way we treat old people, we take them into old age homes and we leave them to pariah. You know, what happens to them, we don't care. They could be, abused, whatever can happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't happen as much in India. It does happen everywhere, but it doesn't happen as much. So what I think I'm trying to convey is you have to consider the society as a whole, and while raising an animal for food and then killing it and eating it is okay, but that also could be considered wrong, right?
Yeah, we need to take a quick break, Murali, so we will get your response from Jean after this break. Thank you so much for your call. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Jean Cazes is my guest. Her new book is called Animal Kind, What We Owe to Animals.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jean Cazes. She is adjunct professor of philosophy at SMU and author of the new book Animal Kind, What We Owe to Animals. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Before the break, Jean, Murali called and talked about an American cultural overlay in our understanding of whether it's appropriate for a human being to pull a rickshaw. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Okay. I think he makes a good point. And let me just clarify what I meant earlier on. What I was saying is that there are people at sort of the far end of the animal rights spectrum who equate an animal doing something with a human being doing that very same thing. So those people would look at a human being pulling a rickshaw and they would say, whatever judgment we make about that, we should also make about an ox pulling a plow. Now, what is that judgment? All I meant to call attention to was that some people think it should be the same judgment. My view is that, no, there are just two sets of issues. It could be that it's bad for a human being to pull a rickshaw, but okay for an ox to pull a plow. It could be. Now, because there are differences between people and oxen. Now, is it really bad for a person to pull a rickshaw? Now, I agree that's a complicated question that has to do with all kinds of issues that go beyond my book and my interest in animals. But I take his point well, that there are different economic conditions there, and we shouldn't just leap to a simple-minded judgment.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Bertie in Denton. Hi, Bertie.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Chris and Jean.
Welcome.
I had two comments and then kind of wanted to leave you with a question. You were asking, Jean had been asked about her eating habits, and she had mentioned how she'd come to vegetarianism over a period of gradualness and that she still occasionally eats fish, which that is me also. I will be 30 next week, and I've been vegetarian for 16 years now, and in the last four, I started eating fish. So I kind of did the opposite. I was vegetarian right off the bat and now have incorporated some fish back into my diet. As a vegetarian, I was always extremely offended when people said they were vegetarian but ate fish. So I've been kind of very careful ever since I started eating fish again, and I didn't really know what to say to people when they asked me what I ate. When I was pregnant with my daughter, I started reading the dictionary to try to find a good name for her, and I came across in the piece pescatarian, which I imagine is Pete from Pisces, meaning fish, which is someone who only eats fish. So I wanted to share that kind of with anybody out there that's in our same situation that really doesn't eat anything else but sometimes eats fish. I usually do say I'm vegetarian so people don't try to give me other things, but I can be more sensitive and say that and not offend, you know, vegans or vegetarians. My other suggestion was kind of for the gentleman who called in with arachnophobia, which I myself also struggled with, and what really made it easier for me was remembering that every life is special, even the spiders, and that they're just afraid of me. And so I would kind of talk myself down from my fear and try to you know, value their life and make them comfortable.
Great point.
And then, yeah, my question, Jean, I wanted to see is I myself was writing a book in college on animal rights, that being why I stopped eating meat was the treatment. And I came across a lot of physiological references to the human body not really being designed to digest meat properly and the harmful physical effects that it causes. And I was curious if you ever came across any of the same research, in particular stomach acid concentrates and intestinal length.
Thanks for your call.
on the issue of the word, I don't. Really, I'm not worried about the word. Whether I call myself a vegetarian, even though I sometimes eat fish, I don't take the word vegetarian to be a brag. You know, if it was a brag, then I had to worry about whether I'm entitled to that brag.
But we love our labels in this country, don't we?
It's not a brag, yeah. But I find that when I teach animal rights, there are always several vegetarians in the room. And most people do use the word, even if they occasionally deviate and occasionally eat fish, as I find that many, many do. I think when you choose your label, you're just choosing the thing that comes closest to your diet. And so I don't think that you need to be sort of really narrowly, you know, precise about, you know, exactly what you call yourself. So the other thing about health, I'm not an expert nutritionist, so basically I kind of look for somebody I can rely on, somebody I can trust. And when you look up what the American Dietetic Association says, they say you can be healthy on all sorts of diets, including meat, not including meat. Another source I trust is Marion Nestle, the well-known nutritionist. She says a whole range of diets can be healthy. So I'm really not terribly attracted to the idea that we can't eat meat or to the idea that a vegan diet is, you know, the best one for health. I just don't see that in the literature.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Colin in Plano. Hey, Colin.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I was going to ask about the kind of biological origins and evolutionary biology a little bit. People, you know, evolved eating all kinds of things, and that ability to adapt was probably one of the things that gave humankind an advantage over others. And I was wondering if you could comment on maybe the what's changed such that we should perhaps move towards an ethical veganism or something like that.
Thanks for your call.
My basic argument is that it is just basically disrespectful to kill an animal for food, but it matters why you're doing that. If you have a serious health reason to do that, that makes a difference. And I think that through some of our history, people have had serious health reasons to eat animals. And that remains true in some parts of the world right now. In fact, an organization that interests me a lot is Heifer International, which actually tries to help people in developing countries by bringing them sort of the gift of livestock.
You donate money, and essentially someone in a developing country is given this to start out a business.
Right. Sometimes it's to start out a business. Yeah, I think a lot of times it has a business role. Or it might be an animal to pull a plow. It might be an animal to supply milk. Sometimes these people are in really desperate straits where just having milk to drink will help them out. For example, Heifer International has a very nice little video clip of a woman with AIDS who put on a whole lot of weight because she was able to drink milk. Plus, she had that business element to it. In that kind of case, you've got the use of animals serving a very important and vital purpose. I think that can be justified. I think that's okay. So I think what's gone on for people like me, you know, and people in an affluent society, is that we have sort of evolved and developed, and our history has brought it to pass that we just don't need to eat animals. We have plenty of alternatives. They're delicious alternatives. And so in a way, that's just marvelous for us. I mean, that shows a great success. And the way, it's sort of sad because it makes it much harder to justify eating things that many people do find tasty.
Do we have an obligation, Gene, to advocate for animals beyond the personal choices that we make in terms of what we ourselves are consuming?
Yes. And I think there does tend to be too much focus on what we ourselves are consuming, as if this is all kind of a matter of purity, you know, whether you are consuming or not consuming. I think that's, you know, it's important, but it's not everything. There's an interesting statistic that shows that over half of animal advocates are not vegetarians at all. So they're out there doing important things for animals and not making the change to their diet.
So it doesn't necessarily negate what they're doing.
No, and there are some really important things that they're doing. For example, I think working to get Proposition 2 passed in California in 2008 was a tremendously important thing. And that proposition changed the law so that veal calves and pigs and chickens had to have enough room to move around. And the Humane Society is working towards a similar referendum in Ohio right now. And there are, you know, lots of people pounding the streets trying to get that referendum on the ballot. I don't know what they eat, but it's really important for them to do that because right now I think something like 3% of Americans are vegetarians. So that leaves the other 97% who are eating animals, and those animals just have to be treated better. So any activist who wants to get involved in bringing that about, it's just more power to them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Nathan in Red Oak. Hello, Nathan.
Yes, ma'am. I would like to make a couple of quick questions and actually clarify on something real quick to our dear author. I just wanted to clarify, you do believe in the evolutionary theory?
Yes, of course.
All righty. I was just trying to get a better perspective on where we're coming from here. A moment ago, you mentioned how that due to the inherent value of cows, they may or may not be more suitable for slaughter or food. Just a moment ago, I mean, you just finished that comment, and I actually wanted to bring kind of a disagreement with that, because if you follow that train of thought, then there are times throughout history where cities have been sieged and all other sources of food have been extinguished, and people have actually gone to the pragmatic point of eating their own children, to the point of saying that, well, it's perfectly suitable because it was the last means of food.
Well, this is something that you actually cover,
yes.
The idea that we never think it's okay to eat people.
Okay, I think this is a very complicated question and that actually a good question. If we make value distinctions among animals and between the human animal and other species, then should we make similar distinctions among when we're talking about a purely human community? So would it be justifiable for, you know, the super smart people to eat the not so smart people in a time of famine? And I certainly want to say no, that these value distinctions between species do not carry over to similar distinctions between human beings. Now, how can you sort of block that move from the one to the other? In the book, I several times make a social contract argument, which says that although we do owe respect and compassion to animals as well as to human beings, there are additional layers involved in our ethical treatment of human beings. There's sort of more to to ethics where it pertains to human beings than there is to animals. Now, that more has to do with things we agree upon. For example, in a time of famine, we sort of agree no eating each other. And I think a wonderful book that kind of examines that is The Road by Cormac McCarthy, where you sort of see this apocalyptic world where people have thrown out this agreement not to eat each other. And so they live in just terrible fear of each other. In that book, you actually see a father and a son who travel along a road and are so afraid of other people that they basically don't talk to anybody for a year. And that kind of shows you what happens to human life when we throw out these sorts of agreements. So I think that the question, the very difficult philosophical question is, if we make this agreement so as to protect each other and to rule out eating each other, why doesn't that agreement somehow, why doesn't that take in animals? Why don't we extend our agreement so that it, so we also agree not to eat squirrels, in a time of famine or whatever? I think that's a very difficult philosophical question. I'm just going to say that I hope you, if you're interested in it, read those passages of the book, and they may convince you and they may not.
What do you think are the best entrees for people who are far on the vegan side and people who are far on the carnivore side to get together and at least understand each other's perspective on the issue?
Well, what kind of food did you say? Is
that, well, no. What did you say? Pardon me. I said entrees.
Oh, yeah. I thought
it was
literally
an unintentional pun.
I'm like, I think Maude Jaffrey, really good
pasta.
Molly
you can never go
pasta.
Wrong. Although there's egg in it. No. Are there particular ways that people can get together and at least not resent each other's existence in civil discourse?
I think that there are some very basic things that people ought to be able to agree on, which, for example, I think that we really ought to be able to agree that we shouldn't unnecessarily cause an animal harm. This is something that vegans will agree on, and I think any omnivore, most sensitive people who care about their dogs and cats will agree, no unnecessary harm. Now, I think they can talk and they can probably agree on a lot of things that we should not do based on that principle, like no animal fighting, for example. But I think when you really press them on what's necessary, what's not necessary, they will gradually start to disagree.
Jean Cazes is adjunct professor of philosophy at SMU. Her new book is called Animal Kind, What We Owe to Animals. Jean, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.